I'll tell you something I love about being in France, in addition to some seriously delicious butter, and that is the wide selection of wines I can find in France for low prices. It can be much more difficult to source those same bottles back in the States, and that's why I love to buy wines out of France with Ideal Wine. I have bottles shipped to me, hassle-free. It's easy. Ideal Wine has a new auction every week and is a great source for iconic names like Ouette, Louis Roeder, and Domaine Lefleuve, as well as rising stars like Arnaud Lachaud, Gonon, and Tissot. Find the wines you'd rather be drinking at idealwine.com. That's IDEALWINE.com and have the wine shipped to you in the States. Use the promo code FIRST, FIRST, for $15 off your first order of $150 or more. Hey, that's $15 you could save, and that is some good butter money. See for yourself at Ideal Wine.
I'll Drink to That, where we get behind the scenes of the beverage business. I'm Levy Dalton.
I'm Erin Scala.
And here's our show today.
The town of Nizza Monferrato is nestled in Asti's Belbo River Valley. With preserved ancient architecture, a centuries-old bell tower, archways, and cobblestone streets, this seemingly quiet and quaint town has had quite an impressive presence in the Piedmonte over the last 800 years or so. It was fought over by various European monarchies as a key strategic location, a gateway to powerful cities in the south, in a push for land farther down the peninsula. The 17th century was a dark century, marked with multiple tumultuous fights and power struggles, and devastating plague outbreaks that took their toll on the community. During the Industrial Revolution, many young girls from the country sought jobs in the neighboring cities, and when they arrived, they found themselves at risk to homelessness and hunger, and in need of job skills to stay off the streets. This transition in the mid-1800s from agriculture jobs to city jobs can be seen in the life details of local saint Maria Mazzarello. Maria's parents were vineyard workers, but after a bout with typhoid fever, she couldn't work in the fields with them, so she apprenticed as a seamstress during the area's textile boom, when this region was known for silks. Maria founded a refuge nearby for street girls to house them and teach them sewing. Today, Nizza Monferrato is more well known for wine than silks, and Barbera is the prized grape variety. Locals likely drank Barbera in the 1800s, and the grape expanded in popularity as winemakers struggled to replant their vineyards after the phylloxera epidemic in the late 1800s. By the early 1900s, Barbera was a vinous voice of Asti. In addition to Barbera and the wine industry, the town is famous for an agricultural product called cardo gobo, a thistle-like plant that looks a bit like a curved stalk of celery, but it tastes more like an artichoke. Local growers bury the plant underground towards the end of the growing season, and it loses its chlorophyll and bitterness. It takes on a whitish-yellow color, and it becomes extremely palatable. While underground, the plant pushes to the surface, seeking sunlight, and takes on a distinctive curve due to this particular style of cultivation. On a more sobering note, it's impossible to mention the history of this town without noting Nizza Monferrato's involvement in World War II. The town found itself caught in the crosshairs of dangerous ideologies. Walking through the romantic and sort of quiet town, you might never suspect the bravery of its citizens in the face of some of the world's most dangerous ideas. In the 1940s, Nizza Monferrato played a crucial role in the fall of fascism and the end of World War II. Mussolini had recently been ousted from power and imprisoned. Then he was rescued by Nazi Germany and strategically installed by Hitler in northern Italy. Mussolini organized a new fascist state called the Italian Social Republic, and this triggered a new clash of fascist and anti-fascist ideologies in the area. Anti-fascist groups in many northern Italian cities launched a type of guerrilla war on the Italian Social Republic in late 1944. Nizza Monferrato served as a center of anti-fascist sentiment in a time when nearby Mussolini had strong Nazi support. And in 1944, Nizza Monferrato managed to declare a type of freedom and organize themselves under self-rule for about 3 months. Several other cities liberated themselves as well and formed a free zone. Though most of these strongholds lasted only a few months, this resistance sent a big message to global powers, and it helped to signal the end of World War II. After weathering a politically tumultuous, harsh winter, Allies gained control of northern Italy in the spring of 1945, and Nizza Monferrato could begin its healing. Part of that healing was a recommitment to the region's products, like Cardogobo and Barbera. Since the 1950s, Nizza Monferrato has struck a unique balance between honoring the city's ancient past, including preserving architecture from the 1300s through the 1600s in many parts of the city, and modernizing a bit to encompass a current identity, such as turning the historic cattle market into a community center. This same negotiation between past and present can be found in some of the area's local wineries. Keep listening to hear more from one winery who's based out of this interesting, important, and enchanting town in northern Italy.
It's not enough to make great wine. You also have to reach the consumer that appreciates that wine. And that's where Offset is an incredible asset. Offset is an independent brand design and commerce technology company that connects with wineries on a human level to help them connect with consumers on a human level. Offset is based in wine country and staffed by creative strategists and technologists who are superb at helping create and evolve wine brands through visual identity and package design, developing the look, feel, and tone of your web content, as well as building beautiful and effective websites powered by their proprietary e-commerce platform, Offset Commerce. That's why leaders like Frog's Leap, Grace Family Vineyards, and Rain Winery already rely on Offset. Reach out to the brilliant team at Offset at offsetpartners.com. That's OFFSET. Partners with an S.com. Offset is focused on the wine industry and can embrace the nuanced needs of your wine brand. Martina Barozia of Scarpa in Nizza. Hello, how are you?
Fine, thanks. And you?
Very nice to see you. So what's the history of Scarpa? When did it begin?
The winery was founded in 1854. In the last 100 years, for sure, one of the most important personality of our history was Mario Pesce. I met him in 2001 when my mother started to work in Scarpa. And my mother had the pleasure to work with him for 4 years before his death. And I had the pleasure to meet him in person, and even if I was just a teenager. Mario Pesce, I think, was a very smart man because he had the possibility in the 60s to study in France. So he had the possibility to bring something from France to Italy, to Piemonte. And Mario was very, very interesting in having an excellent traditional wine, but also, for example, a fantastic old style image. So if today you could have a bottle of Scarpa and you could have a very old style bottle, we have also traditional wine inside, and this match is thanks to Mario Pesce. So, you know, sometimes you find a very traditional style label and inside wine is not really traditional. With Scarpa, you have both old style image and traditional wine, thanks to Mario Pesce for sure. Then he spent 100% of his life in the winery, and he decided to start to make an excellent Barbera. When Mario Pesce was young, Barbera in Piemonte was a very everyday wine. In most of the case, it was vinified white, so this is something unbelievable today, and it was anyway very easy drinking. With Mario Pesce, Barbera has changed a lot. One of his best friends, Giacomo Bologna, and him spent a lot of dinners together, and they had at the end the same idea. We could create a very, very important Barbera. Mario Pesce preferred to have a more traditional, old-style Barbera. So the idea at the base was the same, a long Barbera that you could lay age for so many years, for a long period. The one of Scarpa was, and he's, with French Allier oak. Mario Pesce decided to use French Allier oak since the beginning and not Slavonian oak, because his idea was that the elegance of French Allier oak was perfect with Barbera, with the acidity of Barbera. And so he created La Bogliona. La Bogliona is our best crew at the moment.
And where's that crew?
In Castello Rocchero. Castello Rocchero is a very small village near Nizza Monferrato, where we have the historical address. And it's in the heart of our Poderi Bricchi. Poderi Bricchi is the name of our estate. We have 50 hectares, but just 25, 27 hectares with vineyards.
La Bayone is a sandy parcel.
Yes. Sand for us is very important because sand always keeps to the wine elegance and saltness. And in Bogliona, you could find a lot of elegance and a lot of complexity. And with Barbera, the baby plants, for example, they were planted around 40 years ago. There wasn't one clone, so this is very important. It means that in our vineyards, we find different DNA plants. And this is very important because we want to face the new disease, like, for example, Flavescenza dorata, where there's a difference in the DNA.
So having a multiplicity of clones has helped you with this pest?
Yes. You know, there are different ways in which you could face the new disease. In our vineyards, for example, we don't make any treatment against Oidio because the weather is so good, the position is so good, we have a lot of wind daily. So this is not our problem. But a new disease like Flavescenza dorata, that is almost a mystery disease because nobody knows exactly the cause of this disease, you could face in a chemical way, but I think the best way to face this disease is in a natural way. And preserving the balance of your land, for me, this means that you could not plant vineyards for 50 hectares. You have to plant vineyards for a small portion and try to leave the other parts of the area with forest. So we try to respect the microbalance of the area. This is the first way to face diseases in general. And the second, for sure, is to have different clones into the vineyards.
Have some been more susceptible than others to Flavescenza dorata?
Yes, in general, but mainly in the new vineyards, not in the old ones.
That's interesting.
So this is why one of the theory is that the insect that brings the Flavescenza dorata is from the place in which the baby plants are growing up.
From the nursery.
So yes, from the nursery, exactly. This is a theory, and I think that it could be true. This is why we have a lot of problem with Flavescenza dorata, especially in the new vineyards. The old ones, you know, they have so many years, so many decades. And I think they, if you continue to take care of them and to feed them, not too much, they will survive definitely. At the moment, you know, there are some new experiments, some new varieties that they have been genetically created to face Oidio, Flavescenza dorata, Peronospora. They have planted, for example, a few kilometers far from us. And after 1 year and a half, they've been checked by, you know, university students and so on. And they discovered that, yes, now they have found out some varieties that they could not be damaged by Oidio, Peronospora, but not from Flavescenza dorata. So I think that the only way to face new problems in general is to use the old rules. So not only for making wines or for taking care of the vineyards, also for, you know, current world problems. The best way is just to use the old rules in a very smart way. So I think this is a good idea to be used in each part of his life.
So you make a couple Barbera, and one of them is from a more clay parcel.
Yes, we have two single vineyards. One is La Bolliona from Sand, so deep, elegant, complex, sometimes with dark black fruits. And then there is Ibricchi. Ibricchi is a very nice Barbera, a little bit fatter on the palate, especially because, you know, from the clay, wines in general are always more rounded, very, very drinkable. You could wait just a few years and not a decade, and you will have a very, very good Barbera since the beginning. So this is the main difference from Bricchi and La Bolliona. Moreover, Bricchi has always a very strong cherry note. La Bolliona has always a very strong plum note. So this is the main difference from this crew. And but sometimes during the tasting, La Bolliona is good, but Bricchi is brilliant. So the rule is that La Bolliona is the Barbera from Scarpa that you could age for, you know, 15, 20, 25 years. At the moment we have available 90. But sometimes, especially during a blind tasting, Bricchi could give you very, very nice feelings and a nice surprise. You know, this is nature. And wine is something very natural, or must be something of very natural. And I had the possibility in Scarpa, I'm very lucky, I know, to check the wines during the last 7 years. It means that I had the possibility to drink the vintages in different moments of their life. And it's amazing because 1 year you taste the wine and say, maybe it's not ready or maybe it's gone. The year after, you taste again and say, oh my God, what happens? This is fantastic. For example, around 2 weeks ago, we had a pallet in a corner of our winery. And we find out around 1,000 bottles of Freisa 94. We tasted one. I tasted several Freisa 94 in the last 7 years in different, not only from the winery, but also in some restaurants, in some wine shops all over the world. And friendly was not exactly my wine or a good vintage. Now, 94 Freisa is very, very incredible Freisa. You now have the possibility to drink Freisa of more than 20 years without any oak aging. So it means that this is what exactly they have done in 94. And 94 was not a very good vintage, was a difficult vintage. And Freisa 94 is still very, very fresh and amazing. So I know that I'm lucky. So to have this a sort of, you know, library wines inside the house, and we could just pick up one bottle each day and decide, okay, tonight we are going to have a Bricchi 96 and tomorrow Freisa 99. So
because Mario Pesce kept a library of vintages back to World War II.
Yes. Scarpa had the possibility in the past and has nowadays to do this, thanks to Mario Pesce and thanks to the long tradition. So I think that something is changing. When I started to sell Scarpa wines in 2007-8, it was not exactly the same like nowadays. At the beginning of 2005-2006, there was a big change in the wine world taste, and people started to have traditional wines and to stop a little bit to drink the modern ones. But they were very, very against the old vintages. So I remember that I was in Singapore for my first trip. And I had with me Barbera Ibricchi 2001, Barbera La Bolliona 2001. And I was at my desk, and people that were coming and were trying the wines, in most of the case, they used to say, no, no, it's too hot. I'd want to taste it. It's too hot. And for me, it was a very surprise because I was young and my experience was mainly in Scarpa wines, so I knew that the wines were good and I could understand why they could not give also one chance to these wines. In the last 4 years, this situation has completely changed, And now people are always very keen in tasting not only an old wines, but a very good aged one, and to taste the history of the winery. I'm happy too, because there are some wineries that are starting to do the same. Maybe they are younger, but they are starting to say, okay, now I put 100 bottles in the corner of my house, and I leave them for 5-10 years, and let's see what will it's going to happen. So for me, it's very important. I was at a Rouquet tasting. We make a lovely Rouquet. And 2 months ago, I attended a Rouquet tasting in Turin, and we were around 15 wineries. On 15 wineries, 13 had 2015 as vintage. Scarpa had 2011, and there was another winery that had 2009. So I know that we are just 2 on 15 wineries, but you know, in the past Scarpa was completely alone. So now I think that step by step a lot of other wineries are starting to understand this and to approach this philosophy. Drinking aged, drinking old. So this is the best for me.
So with the Labaglione, which is in many ways the most famous wine of Scarpa, how does that change over time, that Barbera? What kind of characters start to come out?
Making a blind tasting with Bogliona is always a pleasure. First, because they in most of the case, it's not recognizable as Barbera. So I could say that the way of aging of Barbera is very close of the way of aging of Nebbiolo in general. So most of the case, old Bogliona seems an old Barbaresco. Then, of course, I found people that could recognize this maybe could be an old Barbera d'Asti. Anyway, the elegance of Bogliona, of Barbera d'Asti, is quite close to the elegance of Barbaresco in general. So the match in the mind is very easy to be done.
And by that, do you mean the kind of acidity that you might encounter when you say elegance?
Yes, exactly. When the Barbera is very young, you find a lot of freshness, or if we could speak in a very friendly way, you find a lot of acidity. And this acidity is very important because it's the main reason why Barbera could last for so many years. Anyway, for Barbera and for La Bogliona, we work with high acidity, and high acidity after years becomes smooth, rounded, lower, and so you start to have a very nervous Barbera, and after 20 years you find a lady with velvet notes on the palate. At the moment, I think the best Bogliona that I had ever is 90. Bogliona is amazing from 90. And then you find there is 96 with the C-line notes, 97, a prelude to 2000, because in 97 we had a very hot summer. And so it's a sort of prelude to the vintages that we had after 2000. And it's an excellent Barbera at the moment. And then you have the very delicate, but at the same time, a little bit outstanding, rude Bogliona 98 with a lot of acidity at the beginning. Now it's very, very good for drinking. And then you have the special 2000, for example. So in 2000, we made, as in a traditional way, the harvest, for example, of Dolcetto during the second half of September, Barbera in the first half of October. But in 2000, we had this very deep change into the climate, and 2000 was very hot. So, in some way, and in general, the wines from 2000 vintage are always a little bit overmature, because people, and in this case also Scarpa, was not ready to harvest before. And it was something completely strange. The tradition told you that you have to harvest Bogliona Barbera in the first half of October, not before. For example, of course, 2000, if you taste now 2000, it's not the best vintage of La Bogliona, but is very important if you want to understand, first, how is important tradition in Piemonte, because we were pushed to do first what tradition was telling you, and then was chemical analysis was telling you about the grapes. And second, anyway, it's very important because it's a sort of historical moment in which, anyway, everybody from Piemonte and from Italy started to make different wines in some way, because the climate condition changed completely. So this is why now we have to follow the old rules, as I told you before, but in a smart way. So, and it's hard to match every day these two opposite forces, tradition and the present problems.
I think when you have that kind of library and history, it's probably very apparent that there's a change in terms of the weather conditions, because you're regularly trying the older wines.
Yes, you find always when there is a vertical, I always choose to put some vintages before 2000 and some vintages after 2000 in order to let people understand that something has been changed. And it's like studying history.
La Bayoni being a sandy parcel, do you see very big differences between the warmer vintages, some of which you mentioned, and the cooler vintages, some of which you mentioned?
Yes, the difference is quite deep. This is why sometimes it seems to have not exactly two completely different wines, because you could understand that they are Barbera and they are coming from the same parcel. But of course, Barbera with the warm temperature becomes a very important wine. So I think that if the idea of Mario Pesce was to make an important, a great Barbera that you could age for 20 years, this idea was very difficult in the 80s, in the 90s. After 2000, we have become very lucky, and it's very easy, because we had a lot of warm summers, and so the change was very, very deep. In the fresh, cool vintages, we can say that the most outstanding notes in La Bogliona are the notes of sea lime, acidity, in general, less fruits and less alcohol, for sure. In the very great, in the greatest vintages, you find alcohol, deep, dark fruits, more complexity, for sure. And Barbera expressed the best during the warm vintages. So I think that the high temperature in Piemonte after 2000 has become a problem mainly for Nebbiolo and for maybe some aromatic wines. Rouquet is never happy if the weather is too much warm, because it's an aromatic variety. They need not too much sun, not too much water, for sure. More balanced vintages, like 2001, for example, in which we had, yes, a warm summer, but a lot of cool days, and definitely one of my best favorite vintage from the ones after 2000.
So La Bayoni, when you go back to the old vintages, do you see that warmer vintages or cooler vintages age better?
Lighter vintages, they are thin since the beginning, but after 20 years, they, in most of the case, look younger than the greatest vintages. I'm always happy and proud to show people during a blind tasting a light vintage, because in most of the case, nobody could recognize, okay, this is a Barbera of 25 years. No, this is a Fraisa of 20 years. No, nobody usually recognized the oldness of the wine.
So why do you think Mario Pesce made such a dedication to Barbera? Why did he make that choice? Did he ever share that thinking with you?
I think that Mario Pesce understood that if Nebbiolo was the most important variety for Lange, Barbera was the most, and he's the most important variety for Monferrato and Astigiano. In Piemonte, there are a lot of varieties. I think that the most important richness of Piemonte is varieties. We have Barbera, Rouquet, Brachetto, Fraisa. And the idea to match the variety with the land, with the area, is important because it's the only way to let the varieties in some way survive. For example, Barbera, yes, is from Nizza. Rouquet is from Castagnole, even if, of course, our Rouché wine is from our own estate in Castel Rocchero. So Mario Pesce was just someone that had thought before the 90s, before the 2000 magazine and journalist ideas that to let these varieties survive, you have to match with the land in which you are, in which you are growing up the grapes. So I think this was very, very modern, a modern idea. And yes, Barbera, I think that Barbera d'Asti is the greatest expression of Barbera in general.
So the two Barbera, there's a difference in soil in terms of sand versus clay, but is there also a difference in exposure or in elevation?
Bogliona has better exposure, is in southeast. Bricchi is a little bit more in south. Okay, I know that this answer is strange because since the past, the rule was Cru is the south exposition. Again, the warmer temperature has changed this situation, and now the best Cru are not the Cru in completely south exposition. So you need to have a little bit more shadow in some way during the day to preserve the most elegant, the freshness of the grapes. And so this is why always Bricchi is always a little bit more mature in the fruits, and Bogliona has the tendency to be more acidic for sure. Again, this is something very different since the past, I think. But we try to face in a smart way the situation. Also, for example, the new vineyards that we have planted of Fraisa, of Dolcetto, we decided to plant in, again, southeast and not completely south exposition. And we try to cover with leaves the buds during the summer period to preserve the freshness of the grapes.
So are there particular keys or techniques that you've learned when dealing with Barbera in the vineyard? And does it behave differently on sand versus clay in terms of the farming?
In general, with Barbera in clay, you have to feed them a little bit more. For example, we started to make cover crops in 2015, and we decided to have sort of stronger mix of plants for Ibricchi. La Bogliona, so in general Barbera in sandy soil, needs less manure. And this is why the terroir, the soil, is basically more rich, richer, more complex. And we, for example, decided to have a quite light mix of plants for La Bogliona.
So the élevage for some of your red wines is in steel, mm-hmm. but for La Bogliona it's not. So how does that wine get made, and what is the process and timeline?
We made 10 varieties. Most than 50% of our wines are made in steel. Anyway, Bogliona is our, top Barbera. So Bogliona meets wood since the beginning. The fermentation happens in these truncated wooden tanks of French Ailier oak again. And it could last from 10 to 16 days, up to the most. And then Bogliona spent a couple of months in stainless steel tanks, and around February starts élevage in big oak barrels of French Ailier oak. Big oak barrels for us means 45-60 hectoliters, and we use Gamba and Garbellotto, and so they made barrels for us since the Second World War. So Bogliona, of course, now spent the élevage in the new ones from 2001 vintage, the new barrels from Gamba and Garbellotto, around 30 months. But we usually decided step by step. If the vintage is very good, the aging into the barrels is a little bit longer.
So if it's a warmer vintage, it tends to stay longer in wood.
Yes, because in some way, Mario Pesce used to say that the way of working of a big barrel is exactly the opposite of the way of working of a barrique. If you live for a longer period into a barrique, the wine at the end, you will have more wooden notes. If you leave for a longer period the wine into a big oak barrel, at the end, you will have a softer wooden taste. So it's very different, you know, working with barrique and barrel.
And why do you think he chose to use French Allier oak?
If you use French Allier oak, the wooden, since the wooden feeling, the wooden note that you have in the wine is more elegant, lighter, not long-lasting, as the Slavonian élevage could give to the wine. Slavonian always has a very deep influence on the wine.
In Castagnole, Monferrato, they grow Rouqué. It's associated with that area. But you grow Rouqué outside of that zone where you have other vineyards, and you call it something else. You call it Rouché, but it's the same grape variety.
Yes, the grape variety is the same. We started to make Rouché so many years ago, in the 70s. I have still one bottle left of Rouché Scarpa from 1970 in the winery.
Because that's pretty amazing. Actually, because, you know, the priest kind of got going in the 70s. Mm-mm. And he was, a lot of times people think of him as the guy who brought Rouché back.
Exactly. He was the guy that brought back the Rouché. He spent a lot of efforts in order to obtain a specific DOC and now DOCG for Rouché. So we can say that the priest of Castagnole has a very important role in a public way. Scarpa and Mario Pesce has an important role in the backstage, we can say, because we started to work with Rouqué and we have continued to work with Rouqué since the 70s. Anyway, Rouqué should have had the possibility to survive. So Rouqué was called by Scarpa, Rouché, and the vineyard was Brico Varolino, because Mario Pesce, of course, for these first vintages, he bought the grapes from Castagnole. In the 80s, they start to say, maybe we have a small portion of land left near La Bogliona. It's very rich of sand, so it's very good for aromatic varieties with a thin skin, because, you know, when there is a lot of rainy days, sand allowed us to have less water into the vineyards. The water falls down and go away very fast. So why we could not plant some vineyards of Rouqué? So in the 80s, they have planted, and this is why from the 80s we have Rouqué Cru Brico Rosa, because this is the name of the vineyards in Poderi Bricchi, and the experiment one was very good. Another very important thing is that many people now has asked me, which clones do you use for Rouqué? And my answer always is, I don't know, because they are not clones. They are different baby plants with different DNA planted in the 80s. So we are one of the oldest, and we have one of the oldest Rouqué vineyards, I think. So it's very important to preserve the DNA differences also for Rouqué.
Was Mario Pesce always making it dry? Because sometimes Rouqué historically is sweet.
He has always make dry, not sweet, because the idea is that Rouqué is a little bit sweet already in the notes.
So older vine Rouqué or Rouqué, does that give high sugars when it's ripening in the vineyard? Because a lot of times when people talk about Rouqué, they talk about a grape variety that develops fairly high sugars and can have fairly high alcohol. But is that a young vine characteristic? Does it change with time?
For some winery, a high alcohol is a problem. For Scarpa, is not exactly a problem, because in our Rouqué, you could not really feel the alcohol content, the quite high alcohol content. Sometimes we have also 15 degree, but it is always very integrated, very well balanced in the wine. So for sure, sugar content and high alcohol content is something that belongs to DNA. Not too much. So it means that probably, yes, the old vineyards has in gives buds, grapes in general, with a lower sugar, and at the end you will find a lower alcohol content. For example, 2015 Rouché that we have made, yes, it's around at the moment 15 degree, but we are at the beginning of the élevage. I tasted some 2015 Rouché and I found sometimes 15.5. So I think for sure that the youngness of the vines in some way influence the sugar content, and also for sure the way of growing up the grapes. Because, for example, Rouché for us is the most delicate vineyard that we have. And we try always to leave almost all the leaves. We don't cut any leaves into the vineyards.
And it gives a lot of leaves, right? As a grape variety.
Yeah, yeah. And this is important. Of course, more alcohol you have, more leaves you have cut during the spring season. So it's important to cover, to protect the grapes. And another very important thing is exposition. And again, terroir. If you have a sandy soil, water goes down, but also the roots remain fresher.
Was Mario Pesce always fermenting the Rouché in stainless steel, or did he do it in wood for a while?
We passed completely to stainless steel tanks in at the end of the 90s.
So it's really a recent thing.
Yes. Before, in the winery, there was only concrete. My idea is that concrete is good, and maybe in the future we will make again experiment, and we will come back a little bit to the past and have some concrete tanks inside the winery. But at the moment, we have only stainless steel tanks. You know, it's easier to clean the stainless steel tank, and concrete could be positive, but at the same time negative. And you have to take care of the wines a little bit more. We have 14 levels. Sometimes we are a little bit crazy in the cellar, because we have to make, from September to the end of October, around 10 different varieties. And maybe in the future. At the moment, stainless steel tanks is, for us, the best solution.
What is the aging curve of your Rouché? I mean, when have you really liked old bottles, and at what age?
Our Rouché is special for so many characters, and one is, of course, the lasting, the possibility of life of this wine. At the moment, for example, we have just gone out with 2011, and the other producer, they have 2014 or 15. So it means that if they are on Earth, we are on Mars or something like this. And we have a lot of old vintages, so 2009, 2007, 05, 01, and then also from the 90s. In general, of course, Rouché could not last 10, 15, 20 years. From Scarpa, I think that the aging possibility is of around 20 years, more or less. The oldest that we have at the moment is Rouché from 96. So if you like cloves, for example, in 96 you find a very strong clove note, and match with some special cheese, I think that it could be an amazing wine. Also, just to have a glass and relax on your sofa at home, this could be a very good experience with Rouché 96. And then we have, again, different vintages. They tell you a story. We have 98 and 99. 99, for example, has more soil feeling, we can say. 01 is fantastic, very well balanced. 03, a very hot summer, is amazing. And it's strange because, as we have spoken before, if we have a lot of problem with the high alcohol content in Rouché, 2003 Rouché Scarpa should be not so good. Instead, Rouché 2003 is an amazing vintage. Alcohol has become very smooth and is very drinkable at the moment. I had several times with the Turbo, And it was a very good experience. And then we have, you know, 05, 07, 09 is still amazing. And 11 is an exceptional vintage. I like 11 for Barbera and for aromatic wines in general. I think is one of the best of the last 6 years.
And what about Freisa?
Freisa, again, is one of my favorite variety. It's very Piemonte style because it's a little bit rude and keep you away, especially at the beginning. Then after some years, it becomes, you know, more calm, relaxed, and you could enjoy it. Freisa for Mario Pesce was the wild version of Nebbiolo. So the theory supported by Mario Pesce was Freisa is the old version of Nebbiolo. This is why in Freisa, what you find in Nebbiolo, in Freisa you find the same notes, but in a stronger way. Like tannins, especially in the first years, tannins are very strong and you have your mouth that could not face them. So Freisa is something very native, we can say, autochthonous. And we have the pleasure to make Freisa dry and completely still. I like it a lot. It's one of my favorite variety. We have around 1 hectare of Freisa at the moment. And year per year, we decide if we put Freisa into wood or not. Sometimes we let her have the fermentation into the truncated wooden tanks, sometimes in stainless steel tanks, and sometimes we prefer to have an élevage of for Freisa into the big oak barrels, sometimes not. So we try to respect a lot the character of the vintage. Freisa is very rude, so you have to take care of Freisa a lot if you want to have a balanced wine. If you don't take care of Freisa, you at last you have not a good wine, definitely. I think it's one of the most difficult wine to be vinified in Piemonte.
So what are some of the keys to taking care of it? I mean, what's really important?
I think the most delicate moment is the fermentation period. You know, it's wild in the DNA. So you could obtain good feelings. But at a certain point, you have to be careful because the wild notes could come out. And so you have to check daily the situation and let Freisa have fermentation as soon as possible. Because it's very wild and sometimes you could obtain not exactly the best from the grapes, but also, you know, the ancestral notes that they are not really, really pleasant. And then, of course, it's important that you work with acidity, not too much, because if at the end, if you will have too much tannins and too much acidity, you will have a not drinkable Freisa. So it's important that the vintage is very well balanced. This is why we don't produce Freisa each year. For us, this is not possible. We prefer to keep Freisa just in the best vintages. In some vintages, we sell the grapes.
What about Nebbiolo? Because you have a Roero-based Nebbiolo, a Barbaresco from Neve, a Lamora Nebbiolo, and then there was a period of time for a Monforte Barolo. So when those grapes come in, how do you start to approach those different sources for Nebbiolo?
Mario Pesce was very keen, you know, in taking care of a lot of varieties from Piemonte. So I think this is why he started to buy the grapes for making Nebbiolo, Barolo and Barbaresco so many years ago. In the winery, when you arrive in the reception area, you find there is a sort of small museum and there is a bottle of Barolo from 1948. So the idea was, again, very modern because Mario Pesce was in Nizza Monferrato, not in Langa. But probably already his uncle, Pasquale, understood that Nebbiolo was the future in some way, was an excellent grape to work with. And so they started to buy some grapes from Langa. At that time, I think that there were few wineries Of course, there were the historical ones, but the others were mainly farmers. And so it, at that time, was very easy finding out grapes for making Barolo, Barbaresco and Nebbiolo in Nizza. At the moment, the situation is completely different. Of course, the Nebbiolo has become very popular in the last 20, 25 years. But we should remember that in the 50s, the most popular variety, the most popular wine in Italy for consumption was Dolcetto. And at that time, wineries and farmers, they give us free samples, Nebbiolo. So if the client took a tank of Dolcetto, okay, please, I give you for free some Barolo Barbaresco because, you know, there is nobody that wants this wine. So today the situation is, of course, exactly the opposite. And Scarpa, in some way, again, could tell you this story. So this is why in the 50s and in the 60s, we had not only two, but five different levels of Barolo. Unfortunately, at the moment, we have found out just Tettimorra and Costa di Monforte and just few information, you know, only by words about the three others. But my dream is to find out some bottles left somewhere in the world. And maybe in our next interview, I will tell, yes, we will make, you know, this Barolo from Serralunga. And so... sure that at the end my mission will be completed. Then, at the moment, we have Tettimorra and Tettineive still in production, so from Neive and from La Morra, and we have some bottles left of Barbaresco Podere Barberis and Barolo Le Coste di Monforte. We stopped the production for Barolo Le Coste di Monforte in 1978 and for Podere Barberis in 82. The history about Podere Barberis is fantastic because Podere Barberis was the ancient name of Paiore. 82 is the last vintage because the owners of that vineyard died, and the son and the daughter sold the portion of land and the vineyards of Podere Barberis around the 83 and 84. And so Scarpa lost the possibility to buy the grapes, and this portion, this area, became Paiore, so one of the best, most famous, popular cru of Barbaresco.
So who owns that cru now?
At that time, Carlo was 25 years old or something like this, and he remembered that when the owners died, Gaia both the vineyard and the portion of land of these persons.
Which vintages was that made by Scarpa?
The last one of Podere Barberis that we have is still in the winery is 82. You find some vintages with the name Podere Barberis, and sometimes the same vintages without Podere Barberis, because after there was a sort of struggle between Gaia and Scarpa about the name, and Scarpa decided to stop to use Podere Barberis because it was very much with Paiore.
So what was the first vintage of Podere Barberis?
I think it was around 68 or 69. Not before.
And one of the things that's somewhat interesting about yourself is that you recently published a book.
First of all, I'm a crime story writer, but...
Crime story writer,
detective stories writer. And but I could not write anything without, you know, had something of my job experience, or I can say life experience.
So you had to murder some people first.
Yeah, exactly.
Before you could.
You find a lot of murders in my book, and a lot of producer murdered, and wine producer, I mean, and a lot of chef. It's a sort of mix between my passion for detective stories and my passion for wine and food. The main characters are young people. You know, being young in Italy is not so easy. You have to face so many problems. And it's about a special wine. It's called the Fifth Pleasure. And in the book, you could not find what is it. So it means that I never wrote this is Barolo, this is Barbera. The fifth pleasure is a wine from Piemonte. And again, this is our idea. We have to promote Piemonte and the wine from Piemonte, and not only after Scarpa, Barolo, Barbaresco, Nebbiolo. So the fifth pleasure in my book is a wine, a red wine. You find, of course, a lot of different locations. So the Carters travels from Copenhagen to New York to London, and also to Barolo and Montalcino. So it's a nice story about a wine, the fifth pleasure, that is so famous because it's always the same. It means that the fifth pleasure is always a great vintage. There is no differences between, for example, 2001 and 2005. So in some way, it's exactly the opposite of a Scarpa wine. And this is why it's so, it's a sort of mystery wine, because nobody could make a wine that could be the same year per year. There is a special phrase in the book. A producer says, when a formula will be created for making the same wine each year, wine producer will stop to work, because we stop it to have different wines for different vintages.
In the end, it's a mystery.
It's a mystery. It's a mystery. There is the mystery about the wine, and of course, the mystery about the murders. There is the first wine producer to be killed is, of course, a French guy, a champagne producer in Bouzy. And then we have, you know, a Montalcino producer, and only at the end, a wine producer from Piemonte. So the main character is a young girl from a winery. She has taken a completely different degree in law, and she's not a winemaker or something like this, but she decided to work in her aunt's winery just for passion. And she tells you the wine world from inside, but with outside view. So like the view that I have, I'm not the daughter of wine producer. I'm a daughter of people with different jobs. I had the possibility to go in completely in the wine world, but my point of view continues to be a little bit, you know, outside. So I have in common with some of my friends, wine producer, some elements like, you know, passion. We could speak about wines, and we could speak about corks and labels and yeast for hours. But I continue to remain a little bit outside and have different ideas, maybe sometimes more open, because I'm not exactly from this world.
Martina Barozio believes in applying old methods to the current day, even if sometimes it's a mystery. Thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you too, Levi.
Martina Barozio of Scarpa in Nizza Monferrato in the Piemonte.
All Drink to That is hosted and produced by myself, Levi Dalton. Aaron Skella has contributed original pieces. Editorial assistance has been provided by Bill Kimsey. The show music was performed and composed by Rob Moose and Thomas Bartlett. Show artwork by Alicia Tenoyan. T-shirts, sweatshirts, coffee mugs, and so much more, including show stickers, notebooks, and even gift wrap, are available for sale if you check the show website, alldrinktothatpod.com. That's alldrinktothatpod.com, which is the same place you'd go to sign up for our email list or to make one of the crucially important donations that help keep this show operating. You can donate from anywhere using PayPal or Stripe on the show website. Remember to hit subscribe or to follow this show in your favorite podcast app, please. That's super important to see every episode. And thank you for listening. This episode was made possible by Vinitaly, the world's largest wine fair, held each year in Verona, Italy.